welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project, presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, your source for the study of religions in Britain and around the world. I'm Christopher Cotter.
And I'm David Robertson.
And today we've got a double interview, an interview that you did with two people on another person.
Yes, Carol Cusack, Steve Sutcliffe, G.I. Gurdjieff.
Which ones were the interviewees? Which one was the subject? We don't know, but here we go.
George Ivanovich Gurdjieff was born around 1866 in Russia and came to prominence in the interwar years in Europe and later in the US as what we might call a spiritual teacher or proto-New Age guru. As well as a complex cosmology, Gurdjieff's teaching was focused on waking up his pupils. Gurdjieff taught that the vast majority of humans were literally asleep and that discovering one's true will required a great deal of hard work and conscious suffering. His work was continued by his pupils following his death in 1949, and a number of books based on his teachings remain in print today. To discuss his importance to religious studies, I'm delighted to be having an encounter with two remarkable scholars today, both familiar names to the RSP, Professor Carol Cusack and Dr. Stephen Sutcliffe. So welcome back, both.
Thanks, David.
Hi there.
Can we start then by discussing Gurdjieff as the archetypical guru figure, sort of, you know, Eastern figure with his hypnotic eyes and his wanderings in the East?
Yeah, we could, yeah. Do you want to start, Carol, or shall I say something?
I think the guru question is an interesting one because it's important to place Gurdjieff temporarily. He begins teaching around about 1913, and at that point, there actually aren't a lot of models for gurus. So to an extent, he's one of the people who creates the model of the guru. And so he's interesting from that point of view. He's also interesting in terms of your mentioning of Eastern characteristics, because Gurdjieff is a figure who was seen during his lifetime to span East and West. But in fact, of course, he was using the East quite often tropologically rather than in any detailed fashion, or at least that's how I would read a lot of the texts that he left.
Where did his ideas about gurus come from? Do we have any idea?
Well, I think he must have been... He was aware of theosophy if he was moving in Moscow, and he must have been... Just trying to think this through. He must have been aware of Blavatsky in some way. I think that's probably a fair inference.
There's evidence he read her.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly they're very similar in many ways. And
one of the problems is it all turns on the chronology question again, because Blavatsky dies in 1891, and one of the problems with Gurdjieff's life prior to his emergence as a teacher is it's very difficult to reconstruct a chronology, because what he says about himself in Meetings with Remarkable Men and his other texts tends to be elusive and elusive. And most people, when they're attempting to reconstruct the chronology, suggest that he is in his period of spiritual seeking in Eastern countries, which might be India or Tibet or also Egypt, in and around the time of Blavatsky's death, around 1890.
Yeah. I think what we know of his life, I mean, you can interpret it as somebody trying to fashion an image and fashion a role for himself with a group of followers migrating through various adventures. I mean, and partly finding a physical place to set up camp and actually to do something more substantial and concrete. And the thing there, though, is that by the time he ends up at the Institute outside Paris in 1922, there are already other folks doing this kind of thing in Europe. And I just took from my shelves this book by Ron Landau, a journalist of the interwar period, called God is My Adventure, published in 1935. Landau presents Gurdjieff as one of a number of figures, as the subtitle of the book has it. It's a book on modern mystics, masters and teachers. So in 1935, you've got Gurdjieff, you've got Uspensky, you've got Hermann Kesseling in Germany, you've got Meher Baba as well. So you've already got a sense that there are powerful, charismatic individuals mm-hmm. from lands furth of Europe, you know, not from Europe, but from India, in Meher Baba's case, you know, from the Levant, to use that rather old-fashioned trope for Gurdjieff, from Russia for Uspensky, and there's a sense of the exotic, the mysterious, the marvellous, the charismatic, powerful figure. So Gurdjieff, you know, partly, as Carol says, I think, is a strong contributor to this idea, but he's also partly entering a sort of discourse and a frame of reference that people are already starting to become aware of in the interwar mm-hmm. period.
I was quite interested recently to sort of think about the fact that Gurdjieff, like Blavatsky and possibly some of these other figures which I'm less familiar with, is also engaged in this particular discourse about spirituality, or, you know, particularly Eastern kind of religious traditions and science. Gurdjieff presents, Uspensky presents Gurdjieff's material in a particularly kind of scientific discourse and framework, yet with this, you know, concern with man's place in the cosmos and, you know, finding the true self and so on and so forth, which is, it seems to be something that's very tied up with that Victorian and post-Victorian or, you know, pre-war religious discourse.
I think there are a couple of things there. Gurdjieff was very interested in science himself. It's not just the way that Uspensky presents Gurdjieff's teaching as a system, something that is kind of scientifically verifiable or testable. If in Meetings with Remarkable Men, again, it's a highly self-conscious text, and it would be foolish to take it just as read, but Gurdjieff presents himself as being friends with people who have technological and engineering skills. He presents himself as somebody who makes a living repairing machines, and consequently, he's interested in technology. And in one of the fascinating things about Gurdjieff is he's stuck in the middle of a million things. He presents as being in the middle of East and West. He presents as being somewhere in the middle between the 19th century idea of new religions and theosophical spiritualisms and what happens in the 20th century. He also presents as an anti-modern who nevertheless operates within a lot of the discourses of modernity, including technology and some kind of literary modernistic ideas as well. So I think Gurdjieff was greatly interested in science. However, he didn't see that it would be the delivering force that those Enlightenment moderns who wanted to leave behind religion, spirituality, esotericism, whatever you want to call it, seemed to claim that it would be. He thought rather that it was something that the West had got right, but in having got that right, the West had lost other things that the East still retained.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's right. I mean, but I tend to see him pretty much as making it up as he goes along, actually. And that there's a sense in which, you know, the Gurdjieffians tend, shouldn't make too many quick generalizations. There's a tendency to present the work, you know, to use that talismanic word, as a system, you know, that's, you know, fully thought out, you know, it covers all parts of the microcosm and the macrocosm, as it were. But I think, really, Gurdjieff was more like a bricoleur, in Levi-Strauss's term, of the person who was putting together, sifting and splicing sources that he came across, working them up, working them into something usable, something very practical, because by all accounts, Gurdjieff was the practical person in the mix of this, dealing with people, everyday situations, everyday stuff. And if you like, putting together, you know, a slightly ever-evolving package of practices that partly really what's available to him as he makes his move from his home to Moscow, down to the south of Russia, then across to the heartlands of Europe. And the thing about the bricoleur, of course, in Levi-Strauss's model is it tends to be overemphasized. People tend to overemphasize the creative agency, the kind of unfettered agency of the bricoleur. But in Levi-Strauss's original presentation, the bricoleur is partly restricted simply by what's available. So the bricoleur is the odd job person putting together the stuff that's there to hand, but it's got to be there for him to put it together or her to put it together. So I'm sure he is, you know, partly working with ideas of science and technology, and partly working with other ideas about, you know, inner regeneration. But I think, you know, it's he's making it up partly as he goes along.
And of course, there's a tendency as well to explain away the gaps and the contradictions in his teachings, as that's part of the teaching too. He didn't want to make it too easy.
Well, this is an interesting thing, because taking up from Steve's point about making it up as you go along, we've already mentioned Madame Blavatsky, and I actually think that she operated in very much the same kind of way.
Yes, I think
that,
that's
like
right,
Gurdjieff, she was widely travelled, particularly for a Russian woman of the middle 19th century, very widely travelled, and she picked up bits and pieces here and there. Just like Gurdjieff, she also had what we would now call paranormal powers, in a general sense, or parapsychological powers. She worked as a medium. Gurdjieff was a renowned hypnotist. These are things that were being explored in the 19th century and the early 20th.
Hypnotic eyes were a feature that was frequently referred to.
Gurdjieff's hypnotic eyes are no less frequently referred to. The interesting thing, of course, is that the third person who's in the mix hasn't been mentioned yet, as Rudolf Steiner, who founded Anthroposophy, a branch of Theosophy. He was the head of the Theosophical Society in Germany and grew less and less comfortable with the Eastern material and decided in 1912 to break away and form Anthroposophy. He's a little bit different to Blavatsky and Gurdjieff because he has a real PhD. He has a doctorate on Goethe. He worked as part of the curation team of the Nietzsche archive. He's an intellectual, much, much more a person, in a way, I see operating sort of similarly to me. Whereas Gurdjieff and Blavatsky were eclectic, widely read, widely experienced, knew a lot of stuff, but it was not in that category of an intellectual education of the kind that Steiner had. And it's very interesting because there are very close synergies between Steiner and Gurdjieff as well. And I think that it's funny, you can link Gurdjieff to Blavatsky pretty easily, and you can link Steiner and Gurdjieff in different ways pretty easily. The bridge that's hard to get is Blavatsky and Steiner, because he doesn't operate in that kind of bricoleur fakir in the marketplace kind of way. He's much more austere and reserved.
Well, it's interesting, I think, to put Gurdjieff into a comparative framework, which is what you're doing, and what we started off by talking about, you know, him as a guru figure, because I think so often the historiography of Gurdjieff emphasizes a certain uniqueness, a certain kind of sui generis quality, and that's particularly so with the work written by Gurdjieff, on Gurdjieff by practitioners. But it's difficult not to get sucked into the sense that somehow, you know, guru was this extraordinary figure, you know, who is creating a tradition and, you know, creating a sort of trail or a wake behind him into which everyone gets caught up. But I do think that a lot of interesting stuff comes out when we put him into comparative context, and that means not only quite rightly thinking about his relationship to Blavatsky, I mean, not, you know, physical relationship, I mean, in terms of the kind of figure he was and kind of bricoleur he was, Steiner and these other guru-type figures, but also thinking, therefore, about how he was getting involved in fields of cultural production as well. Dancers, musicians, artists, writers have all got an awful lot out of Gurdjieff. And that means we can also find a lot of interest in Gurdjieff by taking him out of the field of the study of religion simpliciter, as it were, in taking him into a wider field of historical cultural studies as well. Because it's quite clear, some very good stuff has been written by Gurdjieff about his relationship, for example, with American writers once his move to New York. So I think the comparative angle is really healthy and enables us to avoid the trap of getting sucked into a kind of sui generis Gurdjieff studies approach.
Practical thing about doing that too is, of course, that theosophists and anthroposophists were peculiarly active in literature, production of plays, ballets, composition of music, and there's also a sense in which the kinds of ideal communes that people like Steiner and Gurdjieff were setting up, groups where people lived together and did certain kinds of things together, like Dornach in Switzerland near Basel, where the Goetheanum was built and is the headquarters of anthroposophy. Mm. These sorts of things were actually social experiments that were happening amongst people who were shaking off middle-classness or upper-middle-classness and trying to create bohemian communes based around art and literature without any necessarily spiritual connections at all. Mm-hmm. So that's another way that you can pull the whole exercise into a contemporary area. And I think it's kind of the decades, the teens, the 20s, the 30s are probably the best kind of time for that, because by the time World War II comes, a lot of the wind has gone out of the sails. People don't feel so confident that they can have that kind of utopic community based on principles of art, beauty, love, etc.
Yes.
Because the war gets kind of in the way.
Yes. That's right, and that also helps us to see that the institute at Fontainebleau, which again, if approached from the Gurdjieff studies angle, tends to look like a fairly unique, remarkable experiment. And this is not to negate the interest and remarkable stuff that, by all accounts, was going on there. It was one of a number of such experiments in continental Europe in particular in the interwar period, including the ones that Carol has mentioned and others as well. So again, that's another way of just reaffirming that, fascinating that Gurdjieff is, in some ways, and this is rather over-egging the interpretation, in some ways he's almost as much interest as a type than as an individual.
He could actually...
He is as interesting as a type as an individual would be a better way of putting it.
You could actually draw the comparison as easily with Crowley. I mean, Crowley's biography and, both his fictionalized biography and his actual biography are remarkably similar. I mean, you also have him setting up an experimental commune. Admittedly, it's a little bit later. You have the journeys in the East, learning this and that secret. You have the hypnotic ability, all this. But then you also have the rather less pleasant side of the story, the relying financially and emotionally on a small group of followers, the constant schisming within any organization he ever got involved in, and the rather large number of people with emotional damage left in his wake. But for some reason, the Crowley circle seemed to want to emphasize the dangerous aspects, whereas the Gurdjieffian people tend to want to focus less on that.
I think it's a really fascinating thing that you brought Crowley into the mix, because one of the things I like doing with Gurdjieff is trying to think very hard about the chronology and figuring out points where we know that he met or spent time with a particular person.
Yes.
And of course, Crowley visited the Prieur at Fontainebleau avant. I haven't managed yet to identify Gurdjieff ever meeting Steiner, but I do think it's very interesting that Gurdjieff gave his first movements demonstration in 1919. Steiner invented eurythmy in 1912, and immediately after the First World War finished, which was 1918, took a troupe of eurythmy dancers on a tour of the entirety of Europe, where it seems to me very likely that somebody in Gurdjieff's milieu saw that. But we also know that Gurdjieff knew Emile Jacques Delcroze, who taught eurythmics, and he was even at Delcroze's institute in Hellerau with Dalcroze and Rudolf Laban, another teacher of dance and expressive movement at one point, which we can actually pinpoint. So it's fascinating to track these people. The Gurdjieff story about Crowley's visit, of course, is that after the period of host and guest was over, Gurdjieff then threw Crowley out of the pier. But in fact, I think that that was one of the problems with a lot of these groups. People, and it's something that we see in contemporary religious studies, people need to believe that the person that they follow is unique, special, and offers something that the other people don't do. And the people who were following all of these different guru figures in the 20s and 30s, they were, as is often pointed out about new religious movement and New Age followers, reasonably affluent. They were also reasonably independent. They were experimental people, not hidebound, not conservative. Or if they had been at any point hidebound and conservative, the guru shook them out of it into what they saw as a more authentic mode of existence. And so, in a way, you could sort of see it as being a situation. In fact, I know this just recently because I've been reading about Catherine Mansfield's stay at the Prior and her death there in January of 1923. Her own husband didn't like Gurdjieff at all, John Middleton Murray, but he was very interested in Miller Dunning, the so-called yogi of Ditchling, and used to hang out there with him. So everybody was kind of swapping around and going to try out different groups. And even Rom Landau, whom Steve just mentioned earlier with his book God Is My Adventure, it's very clear he likes Uspensky and he thinks Uspensky is an honourable figure of genuine spiritual power, but he is repelled by Gurdjieff's often, I think, deliberate attempts to be off-putting, to say absolutely outrageous things, to act like a shark in terms of finances and that kind of thing. So again, what you said about Crowley is true of Gurdjieff too. There was a fair amount of emotional fallout for quite a few people who were members of the Institute at various points, or hangers-on, fringies, as the Hare Krishnas call them nowadays. And also Gurdjieff too was very, very, very much involved in getting money out of followers, particularly wealthy Americans, who funded his activities for quite a long time.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's difficult if you try and do some work on Gurdjieff is that the sources are quite difficult to work with, and there's an awful lot, as you know, there's an awful lot of sources written by practitioners, so there's great primary source material if you want to look at what practitioners themselves are saying about Gurdjieff. There are various texts, written as systematizations of Gurdjieff's system, as we know, by Uspensky, or the text that was published, The Herald of the Coming Good, that was then withdrawn. But the question is, the archival sources. It's difficult to really probe some of the stories that get, recirculated without getting to grips with a body of primary sources. And we know that there's an Uspensky archive in Yale University Library, and there's a Morris Nickel archive in Yale University Library. But we think that probably a lot of other material is in private hands. So you literally don't know what there is, how much there is of it, and whether it will ever fully percolate into the academic world. So one of the other things, then, to put it more positively, that's interesting about studying someone like Gurdjieff is the problem of sources. Where will one find them? Do we even know where they are?
Some very interesting developments have happened on that sort of ground, though, in the last couple of years. Johanna Pecci, whose book Gurdjieff in Music, The Gurdjieff de Hartmann Music and Its Esoteric Significance, will be published by Brill in January 2015. She has definitely seen the de Hartmann archives, but again, since she's coming at the study from the point of view of the music, what she mostly saw, of course, was handwritten musical manuscripts and some other things. But in fact, the de Hartmann papers are reasonably well-known, and the de Hartmann's diary of the escape from Russia and journey to the West our life with Mr. Gurdjieff is one of the best of the primary accounts.
Mm, yes.
The other thing that's happened is that there has been a bit of a flurry of publication of new material. Some of it is in a very randomised and scattergun manner, but it's quite useful. For example, Paul Beekman Taylor, whose sister Eve Taylor was one of Gurdjieff's children, he has in the past 10 years or so churned out a large number of books about Gurdjieff. They're often a little bit undigested and they just have stuff in them, but as has been pointed out to me by various people, they're terrific raw material for someone who wants to make a proper kind of study out of this thing. He put out one, for example, of every press clipping that he could find that Gurdjieff appeared in, which is very interesting. Yeah, yeah. They're contemporary records. No, you know? They're great. And the other thing that's very interesting is the publication this year in Bucharest of four volumes of what were pupil lecture transcripts called The Force of Gurdjieff, volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they actually contain spiritual exercises and some of the things that were previously omitted from the lecture transcripts. And there has been limited bit of academic publication on those exercises and how they were done and what their possible sources might have been. I think of Joseph Aziz's article in Aries on what's called the Four Ideals exercise, which came out, I think, in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right, and that's a good point. But I would want to say also that these have already been pre-selected for us, and we don't know still what lies behind those, you know, and that's, I mean, in some cases, perhaps we never will, and never seems a bit of a strong word, never say never, but, you know, who knows at what point will we find out if there is anything much beyond these selections. I mean, it's interesting, that's a real point, because Lewis Creed had put out a lot of material by Morris Nicol and Nicol's pupil, Beryl Pogson, that's been published, much of it by Eureka Press in the Netherlands, and it's fairly clear that a lot of that is almost verbatim from the Nicol file over in Yale University. So it may be that there's nothing much left over in these collections of material, that it's not been selected so much as simply it's all been put in there. Mm. But the problem is, we've got no way of actually making that assessment in many cases at the moment.
There's also the issue of publication. I mean, you've both kind of alluded to it there. You know, the academic presses aren't particularly interested in funding and publishing critical critical versions of the critical editions, rather, of these of Gurdjieff's work and letters and papers, because they don't see it as really religion. So the people who do publish it are private publishing houses, generally owned by Gurdjieffians or people with some sympathy towards that kind of worldview. And so, you know, we get, there's another layer of editing goes on there, perhaps, and that also. That feeds back into its reception by, you know, other scholars who may not want to use this material because it's not seen as being properly published.
I think it's a fascinating point, because it makes the issue about those of us who work on contemporary religious subjects, there's a big difficulty dealing with what's a primary source and what's a secondary source. And whereas, for example, people can constantly apply for money and get funded to produce new editions of classical or medieval texts, these sorts of critical editions that would be extremely helpful to people working in the contemporary field of religion, spirituality, cultural currents, you can't actually get any money for that because it's not seen as having the same value as a new issue, new edition of Cicero or whatever.
So it's, again, it's partly or maybe largely a question of status again, and not even just status of Gurdjieff within the study of religion, but status of Gurdjieff and these figures within the wider humanities and social sciences. But it's interesting, I just wanted to go back to that question of where the sources are or what they are, you know, hiding away, as it were, because James Webb, who wrote this big book on Gurdjieff, Uspensky and his circle, what was it called? The Harmonious
Circle.
The Harmonious Circle, that's right, anyway. I mean, it's interesting, at the back of that he has a small section on bibliography and his sources. And he explains that he's granted anonymity to many of the sources on grounds of, quote, the various schisms, personal enmities, and conflicting points of view which have bedeviled the visible history of the work. And he puts visible in inverted commas there. And then he goes on to say, I've kept a record of the source of all unattributed information derived from interviews and personal communications in case this should be of interest to scholars. And he also says, there's so much unpublished material which I have not seen and which may never be published. Mm. So this is back to the question of, you know, there's a suggestion that there's a lot of material there, but we just don't know. I mean, I don't know where Webb's material that he refers to there now is now. You know, is there a Webb archive anyway?
He committed suicide when he was still young.
So yes, yes.
Yes.
But where is it? Does it still exist?
It's a very difficult question. And archiving anything is often an almost accidental thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes things are passed on within families or to friends who are unaware of the value of them, and then they get thrown out eventually.
That's right.
One always thinks about the discovery of, I can't remember now if it was the Nag Hammadi codices or the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the family that found them had been burning them on the fire to cook food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah, they were being used to prop up a hole in the wall, and the excess was being burnt away.
But Webb's comment, the first bit of Webb's comment that I just read out, shows, you know, that there are probably a number of different histories that could be written of Gurdjieff and the phenomenon, because he talks about, enmities, conflicting points of view and various schisms, but you wouldn't necessarily quite get that from some of the presentations of the seamlessness of the Gurdjieff work.
Although, to be more cynical, one could argue that that's a very clever way of using hearsay in an academic text. And also, of course, you know, appeals to a secret tradition lying behind exoteric tradition is a common strategy, not only in new religions.
Mm.
How Many Circle came out in 1980, though,
mm-hmm.
and actually, by that stage, there was already a massive fissure within the work. In 79, Peter Brook's film Meetings with Remarkable Men came out, and it was very interesting because actually Jean de Salzman, Gurdjieff's nominated successor, actually oversaw the entire filming of it and the casting of particular characters. Mm-hmm. She picked Dragan Maksimovich, who played Gurdjieff, as the right person to do it. The interesting thing was that she made a great deal of changes. In fact, the first thing is to say that she invented the work. Gurdjieff didn't. I mean, by the time... He did his thing with the people that he did his thing with. She institutionalized it, formalized it, set up foundation groups, and so she invented what we see as the official linear tradition. But she also did a lot of things that annoyed and displeased many people, and some people who had a fair amount of stature in the field, James Moore, for example, eventually were kicked out on account of him having published public denunciations of her retranslation of Beelzebub's tales to his grandson Gurdjieff's big over 1,200 page sci-fi epic in which the teachings are embedded in extremely laborious and demanding sorts of ways for readers. And, of course, there were also divisions in the work as to what the point of making a film like Meetings with Remarkable Men was. Mm. Yeah. Annie Lou Staveley, who later fell out with de Salzman over, again, the bowdlerized Beelzebub's Tales, which came out in 92, was already saying in 1979 that Gurdjieff's story was for people who were in the work, and if it was presented to people who were outside the work, they wouldn't actually understand it or get anything appropriate from it anyway. They wouldn't know how to interpret it. Now, that's the exoteric thing you've just drawn attention to.
Yeah.
But it was partly, I think, because at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, we're beginning to get real evidence that the religious, spiritual, and esoteric cultures of the West are deregulating rapidly. And I can't make up my mind. I still haven't thought enough about it, I don't think, whether Jeanne de Saltzman was a prescient woman who saw the deregulation about to happen and started a controlled release of these sorts of things so as to broaden interest in the Gurdjieff tradition, etc., or whether what she was doing was really something that only impacted inside and it just happened accidentally to have impacts outside as well.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to wrap up fairly soon, and I wanted to get to the question of Gurdjieff's importance on later kind of New Age thought. Well, Steve's obviously the person to ask first, but also, and later kind of cultural impact. Maybe I'll come to you for that second. But yeah, so how important is Gurdjieff to kind of New Age currents? I mean, is he important at all?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, Paul Hillas's the New Age movement in 1996, and Paul has Gurdjieff as one of the three precursors of a contemporary New Age, milieu, along with Blavatsky and I think Jung. it's difficult to say directly and explicitly, because I think until fairly recently, actually, certainly the Gurdjieff Society, but other Gurdjieffians, those who see themselves as constituting some kind of formative lineage, have tended to keep themselves a bit more to themselves. I think things are changing now, with exactly what, now and in the last 10, 20 years, perhaps in what Carol was just saying. Certainly Gurdjieff's publications have been, there in Watkins' bookshop, along with all the rest of the material that was in a pre-New Age, and certainly they've been published by the publishers who put out other esoteric material as well. So it's been there in the wider mix. My sense is that some of the ideas and books and ideas are quite sort of arcane and quite sort of tough work for some of the other New Age currents that have caught on more strongly. But I do think where there is an influence, except it's almost by model and by analogy, is on the idea of practical stuff in everyday life. I mean, the idea famously was that, what Gurdjieff was offering was a way of working in everyday life and doing stuff, not in the monastery, not in the priesthood, but in the midst of everyday life stuff. And I think that's a very strong element in what's called New Age culture. And I think that's where the connection is most pronounced.
And possibly in his influence on cultural production more broadly, Carol?
I don't know about that. I've been thinking about it a lot because I was taken on a date to see Meetings with Remarkable Men in 1979, aged 17, by a very serious boyfriend at the time. And I've remained very interested in it as a cult film. And another thing that Steve and I have in common and we talk about a lot is films that we find obsessively interesting for various reasons. So Gurdjieff interests me because in some ways he is strangely visible and prominent, though much of the visibility and prominence is like being an empty signifier, because the secrecy surrounding the official, the group of early pupils, then those who took their lineage from those early pupils. My former PhD student, David Pukotic, who did a PhD on Gurdjieff's cosmology, and it's a great pity that he never published it, I live in hope at some point he will, he used to say the article he was living to write was, if Gurdjieffians are supposed to be secretive, why the hell do they write so much? And it really is true. You can read the spiritual autobiographies of many Gurdjieffians, first generation pupils like Margaret Anderson, for example, or somebody second like Ravi Ravindra, who had Jeanne de Saltzman as his teacher. And they go on and they bang on endlessly about all this stuff and they actually tell you nothing. The secret, if there is a secret, certainly isn't visible. So another thing I've become interested in recently is portrayals of Gurdjieff in popular culture. So Meetings with Remarkable Men kicked that off, because obviously there's a guy on screen pretending to be Gurdjieff. He's acting. But that was a work production to some extent. Peter Brook, who directed it, is the head of the foundation in Paris. Jeanne de Saltzman had a very strong role. So what about when Gurdjieff pops up and other people perhaps aren't controlled within the organisation? There's an extraordinary musical called Crazy Wisdom, which sort of presents Gurdjieff rather like Jesus is presented in Godspell or what's the Andrew Lloyd Webber one? Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that I'd love to write some articles about. Look at the sources that were used by the composer and how he put together that picture of the early work. There was a Georgian novelist called, I think, Zaza Bukalatsa, who wrote a novel last year, which has Gurdjieff appearing in it as a person whom a group of young occultists in Georgia summon, and he comes to live with them and completely wrecks and destroys their life. So these things are very interesting, because the image of him as a trickster, a crazy wisdom guru, is something that popular culture does know.
Yeah, but there's a taste thing. There's a sort of Bourdieu distinction thing with Gurdjieff, isn't there? I think, you know, I don't... Compared to the folk who are reading The Celestine Prophecy or You Can Heal Your Life, or even compared to the people that William Bloom has his, you know, puts in his anthology about the New Age, later retitled, you know, The Holistic Revolution or whatever it was, you know, Gurdjieff isn't in that. But there's a sense in which I think that Gurdjieff, and I can't substantiate this now, and I don't know of the sociological work that has been done that could do it, but I would wager that the folks who are interested in Gurdjieff, you know, like to think of that as being a marker of a certain kind of taste. You know, there's a certain kind of cosmology here, there's a certain sense of artistic circles and music and movement. And, you know, Gurdjieff sets you slightly apart, I think, in the cultic milieu.
Gurdjieff is an elite taste, then, in a way, what you're saying.
I think it is, actually, yeah, I think it is.
I think so, too.
Which is why I think, you know, there isn't, you know, the connection with the wider New Age culture is slightly sort of distanced and slightly set apart.
To borrow one of your puns, partly that's because Gurdjieff's such hard work. If you want something easy, you do not read Gurdjieff books. Meetings with Remarkable Men might be an exception there, because it's relatively short and it's actually, I think, reasonably readable. But my colleague Vras Karalis at University of Sydney says that it isn't, because it doesn't have a proper flowing narrative and things get taken up and then dropped and no secrets are ever revealed, and the structure of the book is just impossible. So actually, really, I think he has a point. If you didn't really want to read it, you would find it extremely hard to read. Beelzebub's Tales is just, it makes, you know, incredibly brain-numbing demands on the reader. And that was recognised from as soon as Gurdjieff actually began to write it, when it used to just be read aloud at meetings amongst pupils. They had to really work hard to hear it. And so, yes, Gurdjieff is not easy. And because the work never did what Steiner did, for example, get involved with the Steiner Waldorf education system and mean that loads of people could send their kids to Steiner schools even if they're not anthroposophists, but just because they like the art or the music or that. The Gurdjieff people didn't really do that. They kept themselves to themselves. So there's also a split between the official lineage and anybody who might be, as we are, because we're not Gurdjieffians, self-educated in the area by reading. But the idea of auto-conversion or seekers via print or seekers via internet, while it still applies to Gurdjieff, because there's a massive amount of material on the internet as well, because it's not easy to read, it's not easy to digest, and it's not easy to come in contact with without actually making quite a commitment, even heterodox Gurdjieff groups demand quite a commitment. It's why I always think that the mention of Gurdjieff in the context of the New Age is almost always en passant and not substantiated, because the people who just throw it in as a line, they actually haven't really followed it up, and they haven't figured that it doesn't fit very well at all.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop here at the risk of adding even more Gurdjieff, indigestible Gurdjieff material to the internet, I'm afraid. I'll leave you with one question to ponder, though. Did Robert Fripp hire Tony Levin because he looks like Gurdjieff?
That is a wonderful, wonderful question, and I have to admit that, admiring as I am of Robert Fripp, I do not know the answer.
Carol and Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
David has delegated it to me to take you out of the interview because, of course, he has just finished doing his interview. We've just moved seamlessly from one into the other. Thanks for that, David. I remember a seminar that Carol gave on G.I. Gurdjieff it was a long while ago. It was probably during my master's, so maybe 2010, 2011, and seeing these sort of strange esoteric dances played. Carol wasn't doing the dances. She had a, she had a video.
From Meetings with Remarkable Men.
That's the one.
I don't know if, I can't remember if I mentioned it in an interview or not, but Steve and Carol are just starting to work on a book, Critical Approaches to Gurdjieff, which I'm genuinely excited about.
Yeah.
But a great interview. That was one of those interviews where I would have been as excited to hear that even if I wasn't involved in it.
Yeah.
She knows. It's not always the case.
Of course it's always the case.
I'm sure it's always the case for some people.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all have our interests.
And we've been having a, you know, a bit of Twitter interaction with some of our followers recently. We had quite a useful critique from someone at the University of California, Santa Barbara, on Twitter, saying that they were surprised at the casual and flippant usage of the word religion in a lot of our podcasts, as if it's a real thing.
Yes.
First off, I would say, you know, thanks for pointing that out, and it just illustrates how easy it is to slip into normal usages, you say that in quotation marks. But also, we as the RSP, you know, are not responsible for the words that come out of our interviewees' mouths or interviewers' mouths, and so, you know, it's very difficult to constantly be policing, you know, like every usage of the term religion. But it is also very good to know that when we think that we're being quite critical all the time, that we do stray into common usages. But also, we had someone who tweeted to say that they were on their train home from work at the end of a long week, and they were eating a bag of Monster Munch and listening to the latest Project RS, that's our Twitter handle, podcast, and they described it as the perfect way to end the week. That was heartwarming. Someone that I don't know, I don't think David knows.
Did they say what flavour of Monster Munch?
They put a picture, they were pink.
That's roast beef, I think.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
No. Pickled onion.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, beef's yellow.
Yeah.
Flaming hot is red.
So if you are ever listening to an RSP project with or without Monster Munch...
I was going to say, please do get in touch and tell us what flavour of Monster Munch you're eating, because it really is important. And this is all data, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. And Daniel will love you for the data. He'll put it into a spreadsheet, and then at the end of the year he'll tell us the best crisps.
Yeah, absolutely. Or... you know, maybe not as normative as the best crisps, but certainly those crisps that have the largest representation in our particular data field.
Well, yeah, I was meaning the best crisps in terms of getting hits for the RSP. Maybe we should be targeting ourselves at specific kinds of crisp eaters. Dividing the population of the world into the flavours and brands of crisps that they eat is almost as arbitrary as the world religions paradigm.
Yeah, we shouldn't... Not all crisps, just world crisps, such as Monster Munch, Golden Wonder, and Walkers.
I think this is quite a UK-centric...
Seabrooks, for instance, would definitely count as a new crisp flavour, and we don't need to pay attention to them so much.
And what about the people who don't eat crisps?
Well,
we'll put them in a category. We'll
You would study them from within the crisp eating discourse. You know, their relationship to crisp eaters. You know, within a crisp based milieu.
Sorry, David and I are just about to participate in an online seminar for the Practicum blog on the world religions paradigm. We should actually take a selfie. and upload it to Facebook before we start.
That's a good idea, yeah.
So that's why we just went down that bizarre tangent. Anyway, we've wittered on. Thanks to the BASR. Thanks for listening.
Don't forget to like us on Facebook, comment on our Facebook posts. If you must go to Google+, you can find us there. We're on Twitter, as we've mentioned. Lots of discussion and debate going on there. You can also comment on the posts on the website, as always. You can find us on iTunes, and if you do use us on iTunes, don't forget to give us a rating, because that'll really help a lot.
We've had 11 ratings. 11.
11?
Over 4 years.
That's astonishing.
We've got 2,500 Facebook followers.
I'm confused. How can we get 500 to 600 hits a day, and only 11 of those people ever have liked it on iTunes? It boggles the mind.
Yeah. Thanks to those 11, though.
But yeah, you know.
One of them was me.
Yeah. Okay. So, thanks for listening. But yeah, also, you know, thanks to 11 people only, 10 people only for liking us on iTunes.
Thank me too, man.
Thanks, Chris.